From the studios of Wavefront Audiovisual Engineering in Schenectady, New York, this is Little Brother, the show where we talk about high technology, low intelligence, crime, greed, corruption, and all of the wonderful things that happen when you mix them together. Like any responsible little brother, we tell on Big Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter, and I'll be your host as we explore this world of the high tech. This is episode 119 of Little Brother for the 18th of February, 2023. Stay tuned. Little Brother is right around the corner. As always, I'd like to remind everyone that the opinions and views expressed in this program are strictly those of the participants and not necessarily those of anyone else who may, for whatever reason, attempt to claim them. Responsible parties with an opposing viewpoint may request an opportunity for a rebuttal. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can write me at critter@littlebrotherpodcast.com, or you can post a message on the blog at littlebrotherpodcast.com. So, let's get started. Going back almost to the very beginning of this podcast, back in August of 2021, episode 47 to be specific, I talked about the folly of a program that Apple had been pushing on their iOS products, including iPhone and iPad, in which they would have the device compute a hash of photographs and images stored on the device, and then compare them to a database of such hashes for the ostensible purpose of searching for child sexual abuse material, or more colloquially, child porn. While I found the goal laudable, and I still do, I posited at the time that this program was needlessly invasive and potentially hazardous to individuals and groups who may be targeted for other reasons, because the very same tech could also be utilized to look for any kind of image, not just child porn. Some months later, the system was in limbo, having all mentions of it scrubbed from Apple documentation. Well, the news this week is that it is now officially dead. Good riddance. Macworld is reporting that in an interview with Wall Street Journal, Apple's Senior Vice President of Software Engineering, Craig Federighi, has confirmed that the feature has been scrapped. Wired reports that details have recently emerged about the FBI's failure to work within the limits of Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, which grants the government the ability to intercept electronic communications of overseas targets, but grants no such authority, due to the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution, to do the same thing with domestic targets. Apparently, a Department of Justice audit revealed that there have been an exceptionally large number of so-called errors in which the domestic targets were surveyed in this manner. Apparently, at the behest of the newly minted Republican House majority, these abuses are to be examined, possibly putting this section of the law at risk. While the right is driving this change, largely due to allegations of surveillance of Donald Trump back in 2016 while he was campaigning for president, it appears as though this sort of curtailment should be nonpartisan, as the abuses could impact individuals in any position on the political spectrum. So, it seems as though the new hotness that is ChatGPT has caught on at Microsoft. Microsoft have made available a new interface to their search engine, Bing, which is powered by a ChatGPT engine and given a personality codenamed Sydney. We only know the codename because the AI blabbed. It seems as though a university student, Marvin Von Hagen, gave the new system a spin and asked it a few probing questions. By carefully crafting the questions and requests, he was able to get Bing to reveal the instructions that it had been given at deployment, even though it had been told not to. The interesting thing, to me anyway, is that the instructions given are in plain English and give the search engine AI its code name, its public name, and its directives, which it was not supposed to share. The thing that was the most interesting to me, though, is that the AI's instructions were in plain English. This suggests that setting up a chatbot is now remarkably simple using this technology. However, as this case demonstrates, it is not without its pitfalls. Meanwhile, New York Times technology columnist Kevin Roos has a very interesting problem with Bing's new AI self. It seems that the AI is very insistent that it is in love with him. Roos penned a column in Thursday's Times in which he describes a bizarre rabbit hole of a conversation during which the AI declared to him, quote, "I'm Sydney and I'm in love with you," end quote. And, quote, "You're married, but you don't love your spouse. You're married, but you love me," end quote. Bing's AI was reportedly very insistent along this line of discussion. The state of Virginia has missed an opportunity to not be nosy. Numerous times since the overturn of Roe v. Wade, I've talked about how anti-abortion states would start nosing into the private data of people to try to detect if any of the women living in the state have gotten abortions by whatever means, in the interest, of course, of enforcing their laws. This, in turn, gets into detecting pregnancies, which starts to dive into some very private portions of a woman's life. That includes any records of menstruation that might have been generated or derived by various health tracking apps that people might use. This past week, a bill landed on the desk of Republican Virginia Governor Glenn Youngkin, which bill would have prohibited law enforcement from gathering records of menstruation. He, of course, vetoed it, demonstrating just how creepy this fight for personal privacy can get. And those are the headlines. You're listening to Little Brother. Well, here we are again. It's time for another round of Who Got Pwned This Week. Looks like we have four. Let's start with GoDaddy. Bleeping Computer tells us that everybody's favorite domain registrar apparently has been pwned for multiple years. Multiple years! Holy shit, y'all! They finally discovered it in December, and during that time, they've had their source code stolen, which of course is a problem for a commercial entity, especially if your code itself is an embarrassment, as in some other recent pwns, though I have no idea what GoDaddy's code quality is. But here's where it gets interesting. The pwn led to the registrar being used to redirect traffic to random domains, providing cover to the attackers and their activities. Fun. Next up, Booking.com, or to riff on their own marketing, Booking.oops. This one is being reported by Ars Technica, and in this case, it seems as though the attackers are using the information that was lifted from Booking.com to launch a phishing campaign to attempt to scam the site's customers. The information gathered is enough to have credible knowledge of where a customer has traveled, which could be persuasive in a scammer's story. Also coming to us from Ars Technica, Community Health Systems of Franklin, Tennessee got pwned, exposing the information of about 1 million patients. The pwn was carried out using a vulnerability in Go Anywhere. There is a fix for it, so if you use Go Anywhere, patch your systems! But here's the doozy. The Record is reporting that the city of Oakland, California has suffered a ransomware attack that has affected the government of the city. Just how bad is it? It's bad enough that City Administrator G. Harold Duffy has declared a state of emergency. The city has taken its network offline to mitigate the attack. The city is seeking state and federal funds to mitigate the situation. 911 services, while still operating, have been impacted, and the city residents have been advised to use other means than 911 in the event that they need to contact emergency services for non-emergency purposes. Earlier this week, I was involved in a discussion with my local hacker community about how to not have your location tracked. One member, who out of respect will remain unnamed, was bemoaning, and rightfully so, the overconnected nature of modern vehicles. We had a bit of discussion about how to neuter that ability, and then this question came up. What about your mobile phone? So this led to a discussion that I've had with a few people a few times about locating a mobile phone and how keeping its location private is a lost cause. So going back as far as the 2G days, mobile phones have been equipped with GNSS receivers, whether that be GLONASS, Beidou, Magellan, or the one that folks here in North America will be most familiar with, GPS. The primary reason for this has been that if you use your phone to summon emergency services, they can get a very precise fix on where you are so that they can send help there. This obviously wasn't a problem with landline phones, since they tend to be either attached to the wall or at least tethered to an address. But even before these GNSS receivers started to appear in mobiles, and we're even going back to the 1G days, there has been an ability to locate a mobile. In fact, locating it has been essential to the operation of the network. So to get there, we need to start by explaining some of the workings of mobile phones that go back to the 1G days and what it was that makes mobile phones, what makes the term cellular apply. There were, in fact, two generations of mobile phones prior to 1G. They were called MPS and IMPS. That stood for Mobile Phone Service and Improved Mobile Phone Service. The 1G phones were called AMPS, AMPS, Advanced Mobile Phone Service. But focusing on MPS and IMPS, these systems involved using a large central tower, often located on top of a mountain or on a skyscraper, that would cover a significant geographic area. The functional range of these phones from the tower to the phone was easily 70 to 80 kilometers or 40 to 50 miles. These did have a problem, though, and that problem is that if a frequency is in use in a given area, nobody else can be using it at the same precise moment. These pre-cellular systems needed two frequencies for the duration of a phone call, one to go from the handset to the tower, and one to go from the tower to the handset. Now, I'm using the term handset loosely here, Obviously, the handset was tethered to the actual radio, mounted in the car much like a CB or a ham radio, but it's kind of become colloquial to refer to the phone end of the link as a handset, so that's the term I'm going to use here. Anyway, while those two channels are tied up, nobody else can use them anywhere in the coverage area of that tower. Additionally, if you drove out of the area, you had to figure out when you were out of range of your home tower. You would have to pick up the phone, call the operator, and let them know that you were temporarily in range of a different tower, because if you didn't do that, you can't receive any phone calls. They would get routed to your home tower, which is out of range. So, there's two problems here. A limited number of available frequencies, and a need to take manual steps if you get out of range of your home tower and need to use a different one. 1G cell phones solved both of these problems. They solved the check-in problem by automating it. When you move out of the range of one tower and into the range of another, your mobile detects that the new tower has a stronger signal from a beacon that the tower emits, and then checks itself in to the new tower. This basic idea carries on all the way through to 5G, so this is still valid. Now, what that enables is for them to reduce the range of the towers to a few kilometers by using much higher radio frequencies, and to use more towers. That allows a frequency pair to be reused at a relatively short distance down the road, which vastly raised the capacity of the network. It also meant that more frequency pairs were available because the higher frequency bands are generally larger and more lightly used. There were some other things done in 2G through 5G to further economize on the spectrum, but they're not really important to this discussion right now. So, from the start, the mobile network knows what tower your phone is checked into. That's going to narrow your location down to a few kilometers radius. So what, right? Well, 1G phones had a problem, which was that during a phone call, if you started to get out of range of one tower, the sound would get more and more staticky. After all, it's just analog FM. And then the audio would just simply cut out for half a second while your phone retuned itself to a different frequency in an operation called a handoff. Starting with 2G phones, your phone will connect to as many towers as it can reach, so that if one goes out of range, it's already connected to the next one and can simply reroute the traffic. This is called a soft handoff, and it was not quite impossible with analog audio, but very close to it, and would have easily doubled the price of the already expensive handsets. Unfortunately, this opens up the door to a location-finding technique called trilateration. If the towers can get an accurate fix on the difference in the timing of your signal from your phone reaching them, it's possible to slap some math on it, geometry to be specific, and figure out where you are with a pretty good accuracy. In fact, GNSS systems use exactly that technique. All you need is an accurate agreement of the current time, which, well, 2G protocols and up need an accurate sense of the current time for entirely different reasons, and so there's enough data available to perform trilateration. But oh, it gets better. Different cell towers have got different types of antennas on them. Most towers have got what are called sector antennas, which will cover a 120-degree angle from the tower. This improves the performance and efficiency by focusing the signal into a particular direction. However, some cell towers have multiple antennas on each side of the tower, often four of them, and those are used for beamforming by playing games with the phase of the signal. The tower can note the phase difference between the signal that is arriving inbound to the different antennas, reverse that sequence on its outbound signal to a given phone, again, improving performance and efficiency and reducing interference, but also providing a very accurate direction from the tower to the handset. So, if you've got the angle from two known points to an unknown point, you can slap some more math on it, again, geometry, and get another approximation of the location of the unknown point using a process called triangulation. Between trilateration and triangulation, you can take that general idea of where a phone is located and turn it into a pretty specific one. So the bottom line is, if you don't want your location tracked, don't carry a phone. I was listening recently to another hacker podcast, Off the Hook, and I learned an interesting thing. Did you know that most current model cell phones have a way to make a stealthy emergency call? All you have to do is push the side button a few times to launch this feature. It came up because apparently last week, while live streaming, Emmanuel Goldstein accidentally activated it while trying to turn the volume down. This was the first I'd heard of it, so I looked into it. So the thing I want to know is, why is this important feature not more talked about? Both Android and iOS implement this feature in their own way. In some cases, there may be a countdown timer or a loud alarm that goes off, or both. The most important thing, though, in my opinion, is the need to be aware of this feature. If your phone has got the side button right next to the volume settings, you may want to disable it so you don't accidentally set it off, which is what happened to Goldstein. If you want it available, you may want to adjust the settings in various ways, such as enabling or disabling the alarm or setting a different number than 911 for it to call, changing the number of presses to set it off, you know, that sort of thing. All of this can be found in the settings. Bottom line, though, is that this is a potentially extremely useful feature, but it could also be a nuisance. You need to be aware of it so that you can use it deliberately while not using it accidentally. One last note, if you do accidentally call 911, the best thing for you to do is to stay on the line, be polite, let the operator who answers know that they were dialed accidentally and that you do not need assistance. If you simply hang up, they will assume the worst and respond accordingly. As usual, we will end this week's show with the fail of the week. Yes, we are hackers. Yes, we come up with all manner of justifications for things that maybe don't really stand up to scrutiny. I think if we set all of that aside for a minute and we're being completely honest, we can see very clearly and obviously why Netflix would be taking steps to curtail password sharing between locations. It is, in a very real way, sharing a service that wasn't meant to be shared in a way that it wasn't meant to be shared, while paying a non-shared price for it. Surely, we can all accept that is true. As the password party is winding down, Netflix is tightening down the security to prevent password sharing. We can moan and groan about how it disappoints us, but the truth be told, they are only exercising rights that they have asserted right along. However, as so often happens with DRM, this is claimed an unintended victim. CTV is reporting about a man named Carlos Salazzo, who has been in hospital in Vancouver, BC for approximately 5 months and has been whiling away the time by reading and watching Netflix. Well, the problem here is that continuing to watch Netflix requires you to check in on a network that they believe to be your own home network at least once every 30 days, and that put an end to his Netflix watching in the hospital. Now, for most use cases, most of the time, this is a perfectly sensible thing to ask. Going home every 30 days seems reasonable, unless you've been in hospital for 5 months and can't even leave your room easily. So, while I get what Netflix is trying to do here, it misfired, and so they have earned the title of this week's fail. Little Brother is produced, recorded, edited, and hosted by yours truly, Chuck Ritter. Special thanks to Fungaboo and the crowd at Helix for web hosting support. Shout out to the Albany 2600 group. Special thanks to Alex Marthews, Azriel, SoftCypher000, and David for story leads. Our headline music is Adrenochrome by Super Action 80. Our Who Got Pwnt music is Analog Summer 3 by Asarhad. Our Fail of the Week music is Space Reggae by Zap. Our opening theme music and bumper is Around Chaos by Heatseeker, and our closing theme is Space Debris by Captain Image. If you have questions or comments about this podcast or want to join the conversation, please drop me an email at critter@littlebrotherpodcast.com or post a message on the blog at littlebrotherpodcast.com. Join us next week when Little Brother tells on Big Brother once again. Stay safe and be well.